Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight I'm joined by Carl Kafer. Say hello.
Hello.
And Jay Bryant. Say hello.
Hello.
And tonight our topic of discussion is The Phil Silver Show, or Sergeant Bilko, or, Jay, there was a third name for the show for a while. What was that?
You'll Never Get Rich, which is the first title from a lyric in an Irving Berlin World War II song.
Yep.
Do I win something?
You win a famed no prize. So,
I actually have one of those. Cool.
So Carl is, of course, well known to the listeners, but Jay is new. So, Jay, this is your first time. So what would you like to tell the listeners about yourself?
Well, I'd like to tell them that I'm an Academy Award-winning writer-director, but if I'm being honest, I'm just a writer and a researcher and a copy editor, all for the entertainment business. Over the last, 20-odd years, film school graduate. I'm originally from Kentucky. Went to school at the Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Moved to L.A. in 93 and started my career such as it is out there. And I wrote shows for the Disney Channel when I worked for a company called Deke Entertainment that did Inspector Gadget and all those kind of shows. And I was a researcher for four seasons on Where on Earth is Carmen Sandiego, Emmy-winning children's cartoon. And
all right, really cool.
That's enough. That sums it up.
So, of course, that begs the question, where is Carmen Sandiego? I heard they were going to bring that back, actually.
Yeah, I believe they already did. I haven't gotten off of my bum and watched it, but I think they did it on Netflix, a new version. But I haven't seen it. You know, but the original was very cool. You know, Rita Moreno did the voice of Carmen, and it was a great show, and it was a great job being a researcher for it.
Yeah. Wasn't Lynn Thigpen involved with that too? Wasn't she like
people do get this confused. She did the original show with a live action sort of a game show called Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, and this Where on Earth is Carmen Sandiego was a cartoon adaptation of that concept, and it was just like any other cartoon. It was fully animated, and it was about the adventures of these kids trying to track Carmen Sandiego, and of course along the way, since Carmen Sandiego went all over the world stealing things, you would learn about the places that they went, and the various clues all had sort of historical facts involved and stuff. So it was educational but entertaining, and which of course is the sweet spot when you're trying to win Emmy awards for animation. So it was very successful and a good show.
Yeah, and given my age, you know, someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I definitely remember all the shows you'd see, the animated shows that had Deke as the production company. So that's cool.
Yeah, it was a fun place to work. You know, a lot of people made fun of it sometimes. DIC, they said it stood for Do It Cheap, because we weren't exactly Disney, although we were owned by Disney at one point. But it was a good place to work. A lot of good people, a lot of great friends over the years from there. I was there off and on for 11 years in research and in the legal department and contract administration over there, everything. And they got bought out by a Canadian company in 2008, I believe it was, and that was kind of the end of that, but I guess I'm sure they're still doing something, but I haven't kept up with it. But yeah, a lot of iconic shows and fun times.
Yeah, very cool. Well, tonight we are discussing, of course, the Phil Silvers Show, And I'm going to start off by asking a few questions. And I'm going to begin with you, Carl. So how did you come to be a fan of this show?
Well, really, I think what it, the answer to that question is, how did I become a fan of Phil Silvers? Okay, because I didn't really catch this show until later, and I'll explain a little bit of that later. But I first saw Phil Silvers in two movies. Okay, and the first one was The Russians Are Coming. But it was the second one that really introduced me to him. And not only to him, but to Jack Gilford, to Zero Mostel, to even Buster Keaton. And, of course, we're talking about A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And it was there, with his role as Marcus Lycus, that I took notice of everybody there, you know, everyone in that cast. And being the precocious kid that I did, then I started researching and going back and so on and so forth throughout my life and catching up on the stuff they did previously. So that's really where the interest came for me with Bilko, was noticing who Phil Silvers was. So that's what I got to say about that, at least for now.
Interesting. So what about you, Jay? How did you come to be a fan of this show?
Well, oddly enough, even though I was actually born during the run, the original run of the show. But of course, unless I was watching from the crib, I don't remember, you know, a thing about it. But I growing up, I knew who Phil Silvers was, I guess, just from seeing him in guest spots and things. Even though Bilko was long off the air by then, you know, he still popped up in things, and was sort of an iconic figure. And I watched Top Cat, the cartoon, which of course is an animated tweak of the Silvers stock company characters there, and with people imitating his, you know, their voices and stuff. Arnold Stang did the Phil Silvers equivalent voice there for Top Cat, and I was aware of that somehow. But I never, you know, I don't know about you guys, when I was growing up, you'd come home from school and there was syndicated television shows on in the afternoon on the local affiliates, and this is how I saw Dick Van Dyke and Gilligan's Island and things like that, rather than the first run when I was too little. And I loved, all that stuff. And I know a lot of people got to see Phil Silvers' show that way, but in the markets I lived in, it was never an option. It never showed up. So, and I'd read about the show, and it sounded so great. And it was frustrating to me that I was never able to see it. Well, when I moved from L.A. in 2010, I'm in southern Indiana right now, and there was a channel on one of the local affiliates called MeTV, which, as I'm sure you know, just airs all classic shows. Classic, maybe stretching it for some of them, but, you know, older shows. And Phil Silvers' show was one of them. And they aired it at 2 o'clock in the morning every night, two back-to-back episodes. And I thought, well, I have a DVR, so I'm going to check this thing out and finally get to see the Phil Silvers show. I came in about the middle of 1958 season, I think. And I just immediately fell for it. It was hilarious. Episode after episode was just fall down funny. No duds, you know. And I was in heaven. I was like, man, this is awesome. And I wound up seeing over 100 episodes. Confession, I have to admit, I haven't seen the entire 144-episode run of the show, but I've made a pretty good dent in it. From there, it was just, this, to me, is the best sitcom probably in history, at least in my experience. I don't claim to have seen as many as you, Adam, by any stretch, but of what I've seen, you know, it's right up there. And
it's definitely one of the great ones.
That's just been it.
Yeah, so, you know, actually how I came to this show was that I'd heard, was similar to you, I'd heard about this show and heard about this show and heard about this show, and I just never had a chance to watch it. And then finally I mentioned my project, and you were one of the people saying, you know, if you were interested in a really good sitcom, have you seen The Phil Silver Show? And so finally I said, no, I haven't seen it, but it's on the list. And finally, about 2 years ago, I got to watch it. Alan Bryan, who is another of the regulars on this show, loaned me his copy, and I sat down and watched all 144 episodes, I think it is, as you said, and just found it absolutely magnificent work. And then recently saw it on sale for about $40, snatched it right up, and watched about a dozen episodes leading into this episode tonight, and have to say that now it's not my favorite sitcom of all time, but, you know, it's probably, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's definitely in my top 10 sitcoms. It is a remarkable bit of comedic genius. The cast from top to bottom is spectacular. The production values for a sitcom back then, you know, didn't need to be high, but this show more than got the job done. The writing and direction are just exceedingly sharp. Nat Hiken has got to be one of the great, great sitcom writers. So, you know, that's my experience with this show and how I came to it. But now I'm going to ask another question, and I'll go back to you, Carl. What has this show meant to you over the years?
Okay, so I should give you a little bit. I didn't know this show too well when you asked me a couple weeks ago to do this. So I've been doing a lot of catching up and so on and so forth, and research and watching a number of shows on YouTube. And what I can tell you is this. Though I come very late to the table, to a party. When I was growing up, in the 60s, there was another somewhat similar show called McHale's Navy. And that one I remember a lot because my father would watch that every week. And the one thing, you know, there's a similarity in a number of shows during the 60s where you had the enlisted men or the workers, you know, get one over on the higher ups. And there's a number of shows like that. And to me, in coming now and researching and looking at Bilko, it is so much sharper than McHale's Navy. There's two reasons for that. One is the writing, which, of course, is not taken. But another one that I really want to mention is that Bilko is much more set in, I guess, burlesque times or vaudeville times, in that the entrances and the exits and the timing is incredible. That there's this really, really quick timing and quick repartee. And so that the Bilko demanded a lot more of the writing and of the staging of the show, and didn't really, you know, the cameras weren't doing the work, let's put it that way. It wasn't the cuts in the camera and that sort of thing. It was the actors, the writing, and the entrances, and the comedic timing. And the one thing that in doing research for this show that I really, really liked is that Phil Silvers, one of his nicknames that he was given was the King of Chutzpah. And boy, does he live up to it in this show. Oh, my God. It makes McHale's Navy look like a piece of crap, this show. Seriously.
Oh, yeah, no.
And I
this,
love
this show has
now.
Grit.
Okay, say that again, Adam. I'm sorry.
This show has grit.
Yes. Absolutely. Without a doubt.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned, if I can interject, I'm sure McHale's Navy was, you know, I mean, it had to be inspired by the success of Bilko, I would think, you know, just the basic setup. There's a lot of similarities there. And Billy Sands, who played Private Paparelli on Bilko, was a regular on McHale as Tinker Bell. So there's that link, too. But, you know, you were talking about the direction and the staging. And one thing that struck me when, you know, in my research was, if you notice on the episode, quite often it says staged by Nat Hiken, directed by Al DiCaprio or Aaron Rubin, whoever did it that week. And it was a, I guess it was sort of a union thing or a legal thing, but my understanding is that Hiken would stage the show because, you know, for the first 60 episodes or so, especially, it was done very much like what they do sitcoms traditionally, with three cameras going, live audience, and all played out in sequence, you know. And so Hiken would work with the actors, block the scenes and stage them, and then the credited directors were really just the camera crew, basically. I guess they ran the camera, the technical part of things. So it wasn't a traditional situation where one person directed the entire thing and was called the director. And I don't know if that's unique in television history or not, but it's, I mean, I haven't heard of it before. But I think coming from stage backgrounds, like you know, Silvers did, especially, it was really a fruitful approach because it was just so natural for him in his rhythms. And of course, Hiken had some Broadway experience too, and radio and things like that. So I don't know. It did make for, I think, a different kind of a energy that you don't always see in the older shows.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you mean to jump question? But.
No, I think that's fine because that actually lets me say what I was going to say to get in on both of what you'd said. And, you know, I was thinking one of my favorite episodes is Furlough in New York, which is a season one episode where Bilko and his girlfriend both tell each other that they're going someplace else, but they're actually both heading to New York. And they literally, by inches, keep missing each other until finally, well, I'm not going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but it's just one of the great farces and comedies of almost that I've ever seen. And the way it's staged, oh, shit, that's good comedy direction.
Yeah, truly classic. All the stuff with Bilko at the phone booths.
And,
yeah.
Oh, God, you know.
And that was one of the episodes that Adam suggested I watch, and I watched that and was like, my God, I'm watching vaudeville. Seriously.
When I saw it, I couldn't believe what I'd seen because it's just one of the great comedic episodes. So I showed it to my mother. And what I did is I said, look, I want you to watch something, and I'm going to go do something. And from the other part of the house, I heard almost constant laughing and gasping for air for the next, like, 25 minutes or so. And she said that's got to be one of the funniest things she'd ever seen in her whole life. It's just an incredible piece of work. And, you know, and something else I have to mention here, there's an episode also, I believe, in that first season, right around the same episode, where they accidentally induct a chimpanzee into the they keep calling it a monkey, but it's actually a chimpanzee into the army.
The court martial.
Yep, yep. And the thing is usually comedies involving lower simians don't work, but somehow this one does, and it's because they never slowed it down and let it become obvious just how dumb the concept was. You were just following along as these characters are trying to, well, save themselves.
I would love to have been on that set, on that shoot, because the thought of making it work with that monkey, and I know monkeys are trainable as animals go, and I know of course you have Vilko Silvers, Phil Silvers is so good at ad-libbing and improving and running with whatever situation he's faced with, but it just all came together with that one. I mean, that was just fall down funny. And like you said, the premise is ridiculous. They're trying to induct, they're trying to cut down the induction time of the soldiers to 2 hours. And so they've got it very streamlined. And the monkey, nobody knows there's a monkey getting through each of the steps until it's too late and he's inducted. And then they got to try to get him out.
Yeah, because the poor monkey gets in because I think his name is Harry Speak Up, and that's because they transcribed the guy saying, Hurry, speak up. And the monkey didn't say, and the poor thing didn't say anything because, well, of course, he can't talk. And they let him through as Harry Speak Up. But the kicker is, how in the world did he get past the intelligence test? He was third in his class.
Oh, I know. Mm-hmm. That's a great one.
Well, the physical too, of course. But I just want to get in for a moment and just say, how dare you say that chimps are done? Because I'm sorry, I'm a big fan of Lancelot Link. Okay, enough.
No. Well, I didn't mean to say, I wasn't saying they were stupid. I was saying, of course, they can't talk is what I said.
Yeah, but unless you put peanut butter in your mouth, never mind.
I mean, they can communicate with sign language, but they don't have verbal communication. So I guess we've all kind of talked about what that show meant to you, unless you have something to add to that, Jay.
No, really. I mean, I'm kind of like Carl in the sense that, I only came to the show, I guess longer ago than he did, but it's still fairly recent in my lifetime, about maybe 10 years ago. And so it didn't mean much to me in terms of forming my taste in comedy or anything like that. It's something I was able to discover fairly recently and just fall in love with. So, but it mainly means to me, what it mainly means to me is it's a guaranteed, way to get me to laugh and to be entertained and enjoy myself, which ain't chopped liver.
Oh, absolutely.
So indeed. I'm going to ask this question now. Consistently from start to finish, which one or two elements about the show do you think are the most memorable? Carl?
I've already said it. Timing.
Yeah.
The comedic timing,
yeah.
The entrances, the exits, everything is just like a well-oiled machine. And it then becomes this thing that goes out of control. So it's like a Rube Goldberg machine. You put the marble in, and then everything works. And you can't believe it. And it's all because of the timing. The other thing I really have to say also is it's Phil Silvers. That man, he never considered himself a comic. He always considered himself a comedic actor. And we haven't really gotten into his stage work, but that's where he came from. And, of course, he did a lot of work in films from the 30s on in supporting parts. But, man, it's all about the timing. And then, of course, the second thing is the writing. Because, damn it, that is such sharp writing and character-wise. Seriously.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what I got to say.
Mm-hmm. So same question for you, Jay. What was the most memorable element or two in this show?
Pretty much the same answer. I know it's probably not fair. I mean, I know some people have said, you know, Phil Silvers is the whole show, and I don't think that's fair because he had a really well-oiled team that brought that thing to life. But it's unquestionable that he's the touchstone of the thing, and he drives it, and it's unthinkable without him, you know. And he, like Carl said, he started very young. I think he started in vaudeville when he was like 12. And
yeah.
So by the time of this show, he's 30 years into a career, really honing this character, really honing that glib, fast-paced patter of his, you know, over years of vaudeville and live theater. I mean, so I'm sure it couldn't have been easy, but he makes it look so incredibly easy on one hand, but the other hand, you're watching it and thinking, how is he saying this and not stepping all over himself? How is this not 50 takes of each scene to get this right? You know, because he's just so good, and the timing, like you said, is perfect. And, you know, again, the writing, you know, Nat Hiken, of course, he didn't write the show alone. He had Coleman Jacoby, who had done The Honeymooners, and Leonard Stern, who went on to do, you know, a lot of TV, and he had Neil Simon was there, you know, and Billy Friedberg was Hiken's assistant and aide for a long time and co-writer, and he worked on the show all along. And but Hiken was always there, and he always rewrote them. He always had, you know, a way to make the script better, and nobody got upset about it because he just was so great. You know, it's just made everybody look better, look good. And
mm-hmm.
So even after I think he stepped away. I mean, he was worried about having a heart attack, frankly, because he was a workaholic, and he had friends who were dropping, you know, from overwork, and he could see that, I guess, happening to himself. So I think at the end of the first season, he started backing off a bit, and at some point, he even sold his interest in the show and took his name off the producing credits, but he was still, you know, working on the scripts, and he had this team that, you know, of course, were trained by him. And so the show, I never saw it really flagging quality to my taste. I know some people say it, you know, maybe the first couple of seasons are better, but every show I've ever seen worked for me. So, you know, and that's a testament to the writing and cast, and especially to Hiken and Silvers. So, the star and the writing, definitely the most memorable elements.
Yep. So before we get to the other questions, because I always ask a few questions before the show to prep everybody. Something occurs to me, and I want to ask this, and I know you want to get into it, Carl. You're a big Phil Silvers fan, period, prior to really diving deep into this show. So what do you want to say about Phil Silvers?
Well, a couple of things. He was pretty ubiquitous in the 60s and 70s. You would see him everywhere. And my father was never one for comedies and comedic actors, so he didn't like someone, I generally did. It was just one of those things. So more and more as I saw him, and that connected him both to the Russians were coming and that, the more and more I really started to notice some things. One thing is his Broadway work, which I know we're waiting maybe for a phone call from Bill Reynolds. But one of the things about Broadway is I remember seeing him as Marcus Lycus in the movie, but he was actually offered the role that Zero Mostel took, the lead role.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess it was early 70s, and it was back on Broadway as a revival, and he took over the Zero Mostel role and won a Tony for it. What's the other show he was in that he won a Tony
funny
for?
Thing, was a funny thing on was he in a funny thing? Yeah, he was in a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. He was in so much.
His other Tony was for Top Banana.
Say that again?
His other Tony was for Top Banana.
That's the one I'm thinking
of
as Top Banana.
Takeoff on Milton Berle's success in television. This is prior to Bilko. But he had won a Tony for that. And then, yeah, like you said, I think it was 1972 for the revival of Funny Thing. Like I said, that stage experience was certainly evident on this show, even though, I don't know if I'd call it a stagey series necessarily, even though it's undeniably influenced there. It just moves so well. But you know, think of it that way.
And if I could just finish up here for a second, too. So you've got that, and the other thing is just his character. He might have played the same type of character, this oily sort of con man type of thing who uses his chutzpah and his thing and to get where he wants. And I love that type of character. I do. And I do want to at least mention one other thing about Phil Silvers that most people would not mention. And he's actually in my favorite Happy Hooker movie, which is The Happy Hooker Goes to Hollywood. And he plays a motion picture executive. And man, now that I saw that again not too long ago, I'm thinking, oh my God, it's Harvey Weinstein. It's scary.
Good old Aviera Hollander.
Friggin' funny. I mean, even up until that, and then again, he didn't have to be funny, too. He did a lot of other roles, but every time I saw him, I liked him. I just always have liked Phil Silvers. And that's why I got on the show. Not so much because I knew Bilko, and of course I did my work on that, but because I love Phil Silvers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So Jay, what about you? What are your views on Silvers? What do you have to say about him?
Well, you know, ditto to everything Carl said, of course. And the main thing, I mean, since at this point now, Bilko is certainly the thing, the role, or the aspect of his career that I've seen the most. I have seen, you know, several of his films. I've never seen any of his actual stage work on stage or anything like that. I haven't seen the Happy Hooker movie, I'm sorry to say, but the thing that really stands out to me is I thought about this a lot. I think for me, Ernie Bilko is one of the great pop culture creations, you know, in the entertainment business, certainly on television. It's just a remarkable achievement to me. I think I used the word dazzling a few minutes ago. I watch him on every episode, and he doesn't have to be doing much to just blow me away with his, like you said, timing and everything else. It's just astonishing to me that I'm consistently amazed by it. And if he did nothing else, this would certainly be a legacy for him.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you hear that, like a lot of comedians and comic actors, he was not especially like that character in real life. He was kind of depressive, or at least toned down. He even after the show, you know, a couple of seasons after the series was canceled, I believe he was had a nervous breakdown, you know, and he he came back from it, and of course did another show that didn't do very well, and came back on Broadway and all the other TV work. I didn't keep him down, but it was an aspect of his personality that was always there. And but boy, when you see him play Bilko, you don't think about anything like that. He's just and he never gets old. That's what amazes me. Over the course of however many, you know, 100 and whatever episodes I've seen, I never think, he's just doing his shtick. It's getting old, you know? That's a real...
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. You know, the thing is it's definitely the same character, but the fact that this one character can go through so much and keep you entertained, this is a show that knows perfectly well how to operate within its formula and never feel like it was really repeating itself.
Yeah, yeah. And they were pretty smart about it, too, I think. I think they knew that they couldn't make him truly unlikable. They couldn't make him really even truly a con man, per se. They, you know, he's always on the con. He's always trying stuff. He's always doing a get-rich-quick scheme. But he never hurts anybody that you don't want to see hurt, you know. And he has a heart, you know. His compassion is there. He's always protective of his platoon. And so it allows you to be sort of amused by his plans and his shtick and, you know, all the cons he's trying to pull off. But at the same time,
yep,
not feel that, you know, not feel that he's a bad person. And so it wears well over the course of years and episodes, you know.
If I can interrupt for a moment, I just want to say that the characterization, you know, really comes from Vaudeville. And, of course, it also comes from Yiddish theater. And so you have these characters and that are on the make, that want to, you know, do stuff in that, but they still have a heart of gold. And that's very, very much a standard within vaudeville and certain vaudeville routines and such. Also in Jewish literature, Mordecai Rickler. And so there's a lot of antecedent to him in terms of type of character. The thing that I think... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and this actually leads into my next question, so this is perfect.
Uh-oh. We're waiting.
Well, I was letting you finish.
No, that's okay.
But well, I was gonna ask, and I'll go to Jay first this time. Did being filmed in New York help the show? And if so, how or how not?
Well, I think it did, simply from the fact. Well, first of all, I think if I'm not mistaken, the first three seasons, they were set, you know, at Fort Baxter in Roseville, Kansas, which I don't think is even a real town. I'm not sure, but filmed in New York. And then I think for the fourth season, after Hyken had left, they've set it to Camp Fremont in Grove City, California, and I believe they filmed that season in Hollywood. I'm not positive, but I think they did because they thought it would open it up to more guest stars and things like that. But as for shooting in New York, I think, you know, Silvers was from Brooklyn, I believe. Hyken was from Chicago and raised in Milwaukee, but he found his big first success in radio in New York, and then, you know, some work in theater. And he had really taken to that. And after that, he did have a stint in Hollywood as a screenwriter. He wrote a bunch of shorts and things, but he did not take to that nearly the way he did New York. So when CBS offered him, or maybe he went back to radio, I can't remember, but anyway, when CBS offered him, you know, a show and to do it in New York, he jumped at that, and it gave him access to, you know, all these great vaudeville and stage actors and all these guys who looked like more like a real life army platoon than a bunch of Hollywood pretty boys. And so I think that both Hyken and Silvers probably thrived there, I think, just because they're on more familiar ground, if nothing else. I think it just had to be more of a comfort zone for them to do it in New York. than if it had all been done in L.A., say. So if that answers the thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. So I will ask the same question to Carol.
I would agree. The one thing I would say, though, is that when you're in New York, you have an invaluable pool of, particularly at that time, they were primarily stage actors. And so
mm-hmm.
that the way that Hyken staged the show and so on and so forth, those type of actors would be more comfortable in those terms, and therefore the timing is better. Now, I only saw one or two of the fourth season shows, so I can't really judge. But you know, if you shoot in New York, you have New York actors. If you shoot in L.A., you have L.A. actors. And to be honest, there's a little difference there.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a great show out right now, Barry, with Bill Hader. That's Bill Hader and Alex Berg have this great comedy on HBO called Barry, and I can't remember if it's the first or second episode, but there's a line in it where Barry has gone to transition from being a hitman to an actor, and the line is something along the lines of, well, this is an L.A. acting class, so all the scenes they do are going to be from movies. They don't care about theater out here.
Yeah.
Yeah, theater is just a way to get an agent to come and see you in something with an eye toward getting you on television or in movies. But, you know, I think this is relevant. You can veer me off of it if it's not, but picking up on what Carl was saying, the acting pool, yeah, very different in New York. But it's also worth mentioning, I think, that one, I think, kind of unusual thing about the show and the way it was cast is that in addition to, you know, these theater pros, you had, you know, Hyken had worked with Rocky Graziano, the middleweight champ, on the Martha Ray show prior to Bilko, and they'd become close friends. And Rocky Graziano was no actor, but Hyken knew how to work with these non-actors to bring out, you know, something in them that was hilarious, and he would work with them on their delivery and stuff. And so when he went to cast Bilko, he wound up casting Rocky Graziano's fight manager, former fight manager, Jack Healey, who played Private Mullen. You know, he was not an actor per se. There was a fighter named Walter Cartier who played Private Dillingham, and he was you know, before he'd never acted. He was in Stanley Kubrick's Day of the Fight short film with his twin brother, but he wasn't an actor per se. You know, Billy Sands, who I mentioned before, Private Paparelli, who was also on McHale's Navy, he was a former umpire. You know, and then you had these guys like Herbie Fay, who was Corporal Fender. He was Silver's friend and mentor back in the vaudeville days, and Herbie Fay, he's in a lot of things that Phil Silvers was connected in, including his next failed series. Mickey Freeman, who was Private Zimmerman, I think was a stand-up comic. So, you know, it was just a little bit of that going on, too. And then George Kennedy, at that time, was just a former Army captain who was the technical advisor, the military advisor on the show. He wanted to be an actor, and he was able to talk them into casting him as an MP in several episodes. And as you know, like within a dozen years, he had an Oscar for Cool Hand Luke, and, you know, was a big leading man and character actor. And so, yeah, it was a little bit of everything, the way they cast this show. But then you had, like, you know, his top aides on the show, Bilko's top aides on the show were Corporal Barbella and Corporal Henshaw, which is Harvey Limbeck, and Alan Melvin.
Yeah, and of course, Limbeck is wonderful in Billy Wilder's Stalag 17.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he was in the stage version of that before the film version, and Alan Melvin was also in the Broadway production of Stalag 17, but he wasn't in the movie. But so yeah, those guys had, you know, that's obviously a major Broadway you know, experience. And a quick bit of trivia: before Henshaw was before Alan Melvin was cast as Henshaw, they actually shot an earlier version of the pilot that didn't air that had Jack Warden as Henshaw.
Ooh.
You know, of 12 Angry Men and Being There and, you know, Shampoo and all these great. And that exists somewhere, I think, on the DVD extra maybe. Or,
it might be there. I'm not sure. I'd have to double check my my sets because I bought it a few months ago and dove into it only on the episodes I really wanted to go back and revisit. But one thing I did notice was you mentioned George Kennedy. For those interested in purchasing the DVD set, they do have commentary on some episodes, including some commentaries by George Kennedy himself, because managed to get these before he passed away a few years back. So that's very good.
Yeah, that's
I'm glad you brought up the cast, because this is something that struck me when I was watching it a few years ago. Here's a show about an army base in Kansas, filmed in New York in the 1950s. You have men and women working alongside each other in the way that the army would have functioned at the time, and you also have an integrated army. You have, you know, African Americans. You have Latinos. This was something that you didn't see a lot of on television, and I have to think that the New York diversity might have had something to do with it, as opposed to, well, let's be honest, the way that a lot of 50s white bread television ended up getting very Los Angelesized, as you may call it. But again, and I want to go to the episode that I mentioned before, and that you guys said you both enjoyed quite a bit, Furlough in New York. And this is something where, you know, you have one of the I don't know if she's a secretary or what her role was right now, but there was a black woman in the cast, she wasn't just there to say, like, yep, and she was never just there to say yes ma'am or yes sir. She actually got lines and was a character, and occasionally got some quips. You know, this was a very, very diverse show at a time that was almost unheard, or virtually unheard of.
Yeah.
And I just think that's important to point out.
Absolutely. My understanding is that came from Silvers and or Hyken, who, Hyken had been in the Army, I believe, or I think it was Hyken who had actually been in the Army. And, you know, they wanted it to be, I don't think they can only push the envelope just so far. So there are often small roles and extras and things, but just the fact that they're there, when you see other shows from the time period, you don't really see that. And but they had several. They had Terry Carter, who was in, I think, 91 episodes or over 90 episodes as Private Sugarman. P.J. Sidney was Private Palmer for 2 years. Billy Allen, who you mentioned, 30 episodes or more. Frederick O'Neill was in a couple. And I remember one time I'm watching it. I don't remember what episode it was, but I think it was a 1958 episode. I hadn't been watching the show very long. And I'm looking in the background, and there's this guy. He's got no lines. He's got no close-ups. He's just in the platoon. But he smiles at one point, and you're like, wow, that is James Earl Jones. And I don't think he's even on his IMDb page, but it's for sure James Earl Jones. And that's kind of a remarkable aspect of it, of the show, that might be a myth for some people, you know, today.
And, you know, and this brings me to another thing, you know, again, and that episode really points it out, but this is a show that allowed men and women to have relationships that mirrored real life in a way that you wouldn't see until maybe, and I think this show pulled it off better than the show I'm going to mention, but MASH, you know, you didn't see men and women interacting with each other in a sitcom or a drama in ways that reflected real life, you know, where, yeah, they might see other people, they're not always together, not everything's always happy, in ways you wouldn't see until, like, you know, the Norman Lear shows and MASH in the 70s. I mean, this is really, really groundbreaking stuff in a way. But I do want to...
Yeah,
just
in a matter of fact way.
Oh, absolutely. But I do want to bring it to the next question, and I'll go to you, Carl. Does the show really have a theme? If there's a theme to the show, some sort of overriding through line, what would it be? If there's one.
You know what? I'm going to say they're skits. They're self-contained episodes. If there's anything that guides it, it's the character of Bilko himself. I don't think there's a theme particular other than Bilko trying to get it over on the higher-ups. I think you're stretching it a little bit.
Well, I have to ask that question because, you know, comedy, you know, great comedy can, not always, can have other things, and I think it's worth exploring the idea that it may be there. So Jay, what about you? Do you think the show has a theme? Because honestly, I'm with Carl. I think that they're just a series of brilliant skits.
Yeah, I do lean toward that in general, that there's not a theme per se. I do guess, and I don't know if this would even be a theme necessarily, but I do think that, you know, it is inherent in the character of Bilko that he's you know, so many of his schemes are directed at authority figures. You know, he's sort of a perpetual underdog in that way, even though he very much seems like the top dog and in control of everything. He's always going against the colonel, and it's like David going up against Goliath. And I found a reference to a book, a TV book called Honey, I'm Home by Gerard Jones, where he said that even kids could relate to Bilko's sort of good-natured subversion of authority, and he called him Bugs Bunny in uniform. And I thought, you know, that's I can see that. It's like, I don't know if it's thematic exactly, but it is something I think that we catch on to, that we latch on to with him as a character, and it sort of carries us through the show.
Yeah.
As a running thing.
So now we come to the next of the first of the last two big questions for the show before we start closing this out. And Carl, of all the Nat Hiken or Phil Silvers material, is this your favorite? And if so, why? Or if not, why?
I think it's his best work. I don't think there's any question in that. For me, I'm always going to, just simply because I love the show, it's going to be a funny thing happened on the way to the forum and his work in that film. But when you come right down to it, this is by far his best work. No question. No doubt. And for that, you know, we've got to really give thanks for that.
Mm-hmm. Here, here.
So what about you, Jay? Same question.
Yeah, I think so. I think if only for the fact that it's certainly for both Silvers and Hiken, their most sustained achievement, you know, four seasons, 144 episodes, they never really got to do anything like that in any other, with any other show or any other venue. Hiken. He did finally get to do a movie right before he died, which I do like a lot. I don't think I like it better than The Silver Show, but it's The Love God with a question mark, starring Don Knotts. And it was a 1969, this silly thing where Don Knotts is a bird watcher and he has a bird watching magazine and he's struggling and he sells out to a pornographer, a Playboy magazine type of pornographer, and the publicity makes him a cause celeb, and they sort of an unlikely sex symbol, and he ends up at the center of a landmark First Amendment case, and it's, you know, it's ridiculous, but it's I thought it was very funny, and I don't know how much control Hyken had over the edit, because the film didn't come out until almost a full year after he died. But I thought it was a fascinating movie, and I wish he had gotten, assuming that was an ambition of his to continue with, I wish he had gotten to, you know, do more of that kind of thing. Certainly with Silver's, yeah, just playing Bilko for 4 years, I mean, that's just, I don't know. How can anybody, I don't think anybody's topped that, much less him, so. yeah.
Yep. So, actually, there is one quick question. Hyken also did another sitcom, very well, I'm not sure how well regarded it is, but it definitely has lived on in reruns despite only running two seasons, and that is Car 54, Where Are You? So real quick, what do you guys think of Car 54, Where Are You? Carl?
Well, one thing we didn't mention about Hyken is he had a thing with actors and bringing actors in and introducing them, and of course one of them being Dick Van Dyke, but of course the other one being Fred Gwynn. And I guess they hit it off so well that once Bilko was done, he came up with Car 54 specifically with Gwynn and Joey Brown in mind. And I always liked that show. That was a show that I did catch in reruns when I was a teenager. And by that time, of course, I knew Fred Gwynn from the Munsters. And this is pre-Munsters. But I liked it. And that was actually the show that introduced me to Joey Brown.
You mean Joey Ross.
And, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Ross.
You know, so yeah. It's not a great show, but God, I have nothing but fun memories of it.
Yep.
Seriously.
So what about you, Jay?
Well, I've only seen a handful of episodes of Car 54. I certainly think it was very good. It didn't reach the Bilko heights for me, just on the limited experience with it. But I could certainly see, you know, Hyken's imprint on it. And, I have no doubt it's a great show. I should catch up with it. I think it's on Amazon Prime. It's much more readily available, I think, in that way than the Bilko show is. So there's no excuse, really, to not catch up with it. But, it did only last two seasons, so I guess it wasn't as successful. I don't know. I don't know the story behind the cancellation of that one. I know the Bilko was canceled because even though it was still getting good ratings, the network just thought they could make more money in syndication because that was a big thing. And, I think they offered a fifth season, but R.J. Reynolds wouldn't sponsor it or something, so they just let it go.
Yeah.
But Car 54 was just too good, so I assume it didn't do as well, but it's certainly well thought of. Like Bilko, it inspired a movie, you know, a failed movie takeoff in the 90s or whatever. But
that movie with Steve Martin, I think it was.
Yeah. Which I've haven't quite been able to make myself watch yet. I think I will, just out of curiosity at some point.
Ooh, I've seen clips from it, and it looks really bad.
Listen, it's funny you should mention that, because I was on a conversation with a good friend of mine yesterday and told him I was preparing for the show. He says, "Oh my God, I watched the Steve Martin of that yesterday. It was awful."
it really is.
I love Steve Martin, but I just can't see him as, I can't see anybody but Phil Silvers as Bilko. I do think Dan Aykroyd on paper is probably a pretty good choice for Colonel Hall. And we didn't mention Colonel Hall, but maybe we should throw that in real quick. Paul Ford, was so appealing as Colonel Hall, and he was from Broadway too, Tea House of the August Moon. I think he was, he got into acting pretty late, but he had a lot of success with this. Had a long career as a character actor. And is there time to talk about Maurice Gosford, who played Doberman?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. can we squeeze a little in? That guy, he's the most fascinating character in showbiz. I don't know. It's like he's this, he's this dumpy, hangdog-looking guy, and which is what they wanted. And he couldn't really act noticeably, I don't think. But boy, just like Hyken used all these sports guys and these vaudeville guys, they found a way to use this Gosford to where he was just comic gold. And apparently, Silvers did not like him because it all went to his head, and he thought he was just, you know, king of the hill. And he got more fan mail than Phil did, and it was just, and he was a slob, you know, and Phil was neat, and they just rubbed each other wrong. But it was comic gold when those two were together, and I'm sure it galled Phil too. But you know, in terms of Emmy nominations, the only actress to get Emmy recognition from the show were Silvers, who won the first year for Best Actor, and for the category they don't have anymore called Best Comedian, and then Paul Ford as Colonel Hall, he got nominated once or twice, and then Maurice Gosford as Doberman actually got an Emmy nomination, I think, the last year of the show, and did a voice, went on to do a voice on Top Cat, you know, for a similar character.
The Emmys definitely loved it because the show won like three straight Emmys for comedy series. So you know, and I think Hyken won for writing one year. It's just an absolute classic show, and that brings me to my final set of a two-part question, and I'm going to start with you, Carl. Where does this fit in, both in Golden Age TV history and to TV history in general, and how do you view it as a comedy in general?
For the time frame that we're talking about, which is 50s, early 60s, I think it's better than I Love Lucy. Seriously. I think it's one of the best of the era. It's also a comedy that I'm much more attuned to because it's about the timing of it and so on and so forth. And I love old vaudeville, and I love that stuff. I'm big fan of the Marx Brothers and things like that, and that sense of anarchy. And there's a lot of anarchy going on in this show. And also, the other thing, too, is, you know, if you look at it through the prism of time until now, yeah, it's a bit old-fashioned, but it set up tropes that were not done before then. And so it laid a foundation that people can build on. And I know one thing I did want to bring up real quick before we go was, you know, we talked about Top Cat, and we talked about, you know, what the legacy is. And one show that I think really copied Bilko in its own way was CPO Sharky. And I wanted to ask if you thought that Rickles show had a lot of DNA from Silvers. That was the question I wanted to give you two.
Possibly. I mean, I think there's definitely something there.
I'm sorry, what was that? Rickles show? Is that what you said?
Yeah, CPO Sharky.
CPO Sharky? Oh, yeah. I barely remember that. I know I saw an episode or two when I was a kid, but not enough to.
But it's basically the same setup. I mean, he's a CPO in an army, and he uses his wiles and his chutzpah to get, you know. And to me, it's almost like it's a remake, only with Rickles. It's set up a little differently, and to me, it all goes back to Silvers. Silvers, as I said at the beginning, his nickname was the King of Chutzpah. Okay? So you take a look at any character that has that magical chutzpah, particularly in a comedy setting, it goes back to Silvers, period.
Yeah, the DNA's there, yeah.
Yeah, the DNA's there.
Yep. Now, me, I have this ranked at 53 on my top 300, which is part of my project that I'm working on towards an eventual book about the greatest TV shows from across history and around the world and all genres. The sitcom right ahead of it is Barney Miller. So, you know, this is in pretty damn rarefied air for me. It's a terrific show. Where do I place it? You know, of the really old sitcoms, of the earliest stuff from the late 40s and the early 50s. Oh shit. I'm gonna have to say that this and the Honeymooners are basically the cream of the crop for me. All my favorite shows in terms of sitcoms past that are later shows from like the 70s, in the 80s, mostly British stuff from that era, and then some of the much newer stuff. I mean, my top two sitcoms are Seinfeld and Yes Minister, Prime Minister. But you know, this is just a terrific show. I place it very, very highly. So finally, to you, the last major question of the evening, and I'll repeat it. Jay, where does this fit in both in Golden Age TV history and TV history in general, and how do you view it as a comedy in general?
Well, yeah, in Golden Age TV history, I think it's, like you said, the cream of the crop, way up to the top. It's my favorite of what I've seen. History in general, I think, is a little bit trickier because I don't know how well remembered it is. The DVD is out there, but it's not streaming anywhere, and it's like 60 years old. So a lot of people, certainly younger people today, are probably completely unaware of it. There's whole other generations that didn't catch it, just like me, didn't catch it in reruns or in syndication. I think it's great that MeTV is there, and that might be. And its offshoots, and so that people may be picking up on it there. I certainly hope so. But I think it's ripe for discovery, and hopefully somebody will pick it up and promote it on a streaming service or something, and maybe get a nice second win under it. As a comedy in general, I could just be repeating myself, but it's cream of the crop for me. And Bilko is the greatest character in the medium. He's right up there with Barney Fife and Ed Norton and, I don't know, Columbo, Homer Simpson, whoever you want to name. And I think this just occurred to me, but I wonder if comedy in general, if maybe there's a connection. Were there many workplace sitcoms before this? If you can think of an Army Platoon as a workplace, I just wonder if maybe if that whole genre sort of got a kick in the pants from this.
I don't know if it would count as the first, but it's definitely one of the first great ones for absolute sure.
Yeah. Helps set the template maybe. Yeah,
yeah, without having some more information to look at right now in front of me, I would say, yeah, it's definitely got to be an early, early example. So so that does it for the main questions. And now I come to this part of the show. And before we wrap this up, Carl, is there anything about the show that we haven't mentioned that you would like to bring up?
To be honest, no. I think I brought up everything I wanted to. Again, I came into this late, but it's just so nice to see this show and Phil Silvers given a little bit of a spotlight, and I got to applaud you for that because I freaking love Phil Silvers. I truly do.
Oh, he deserves it. He deserves a spotlight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is Nat Hike and Phil Silvers, this show, I don't know how big an audience we're going to get for this, and that doesn't even really matter. I always appreciate whether I've got one listener out there or 100,000 listeners. I do this for whoever listens, and hopefully they enjoy it. And if the show ends up bringing this particular topic to the attention of other people and they explore it and come to love it as much as I do, so much the better. So Jay, what about you? Any last minute thoughts on the show that you'd like to say before we get going?
I can think of one little bit of trivia that I thought was interesting, just to
sure.
throw in there. I mentioned that, you know, the first 60 or so episodes were shot three cameras, you know, total run through, like a lot of shows are. But episode 61 or so, they had a guest appearance by Mike Todd, the producer of the Oscar-winning epic Around the World in 80 Days, and he had just married Elizabeth Taylor. He was not an actor, and he did not want to shoot in front of a live audience. So they did his scenes in the studio. And it went so smoothly that Hyken and Silvers realized they could do the whole show that way, and it would be a lot less tension and pressure, because they were having a hard time getting the scripts together. Because, you know, normally you would come up with your premise on Monday or something and come up with a draft and you know, and then try to get it shot on Friday afternoon. And it was a ton of pressure, and for these workaholics, especially, you know, So once they realized that, from then on, the show was shot more like a film, I guess. They broke it up into close-ups. They shot out of sequence. It's cheaper. It's less pressure. There was no live audience. They didn't have to worry about not cursing between takes, you know, to avoid offending anybody. And the only thing they had to do was for the laugh track, they'd show the episodes at an actual army installation, and they'd suspend microphones over the audience of soldiers, and so they'd get genuine laugh reaction that they could put in there. It's a cool canned laughter, you know, where you hear the same old woman who died 10 years ago laughing, you know. So I thought that was kind of an unusual, interesting tidbit. But other than that, I think you covered a lot, frankly.
No, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was aware of that, but I almost forgot to share it, so I'm glad that you brought that up. And, you know, I want to point something out to people. This is back in the day when you had 39, sometimes 42, 43 episodes in a season. So 60 episodes, that was somewhere around the halfway point, maybe for season, or two-thirds point for season two. So, you know, this was a significant change for the show. So so now we come to the bookkeeping part of the show, and I'll turn that over to Carl for a minute. So, Carl, what have we got coming up on Deviant Legion shows this week?
Well, let me tell you something. You're taking a week off, and boy, am I busy. So, so tomorrow is our second ISF podcast that we do in conjunction with Incredibly Strange Film Facebook group. And we are going to have Trent Harris on. Trent is the director of Reuben and Ed and the Beaver Trilogy, and we have Sam Eslin going to come in, who's a good friend of Trent's, and we're going to talk all about his films, and that's going to be on Saturday. On Sunday, Doc is going to do part two of his banned films podcast, and we're going to talk specifically about religious films on that one. Then on Tuesday, we have another ISF podcast, and that is going to be with Joe Moran. Joe just released in March, I think, or April, Sister Tempest on VOD. And we're going to have him on our third ISF podcast. Then on Friday, a week from today, we're going to do, I have a very close friend of mine who unfortunately is in hospice and near death. And she and I have known each other for a number of years on Facebook. And we had her on the show. Her name is Antonia. She's punk music aficionado, was part of the punk scene out in Reno. So we're going to do a memorial show for her on next Friday. And have her friends come on and that. She's still surviving at this point, but we're not sure if she'll make it until next week. But we're going to do it anyway. And then the week after, okay, we have another ISF podcast. So we're keeping busy. Let me tell you, we're very, very busy. And so that's what we got coming up.
Yeah. Yeah, and now for my show, for Cathode Ray Mission, as Carl said, we are not going to be back next week, but we will be back the week after on August 21st with an episode spotlighting the work of the director, Stanley Kubrick. And we should, at this point, the plan is to be back, if not on the 28th, then that first Friday in September with an episode on one of the all-time great shows and probably pretty much my favorite Western TV show, Deadwood. So those are the next two episodes coming up on Cathode Ray Mission. Oh, yeah, it's great. If you want in on that episode, feel free to let me know.
W. Earl Brown, W. Earl Brown, who played Dan Doherty on that show, went to my alma mater, Murray State University in Kentucky, and we were actually neighbors. We lived around the block from each other in Burbank for several years, and we're still Facebook friends. That's
awesome.
My connection to Deadwood, but except that I think it's a great show. Yeah.
No, it is, and awesome. I know the recent movie, I don't want to steal too much spotlight from my upcoming episode. I know the recent movie has gotten some flack, but granted, it didn't reach the heights of those three seasons, but I don't think it ever was going to, or that ever was really meant to. It served the function
right.
It needed to, I thought. But
exactly. Yeah.
But with that,
on that basis, it was fine.
Yeah. But with that said, I want to thank you both for coming in. I want to thank everybody out there for listening. And, you know, it's been a great last 5 or 6 months doing this straight. And, ladies and gentlemen, I just, with everything going on, starting a new regular job, I'm going to need to go back to making this pretty much biweekly. I'm going to try to do 2 or 3 shows a month, but we'll see how that goes, at least for the next couple months, because I've got a new gig, and hopefully it works out. But again, thank you everybody for participating. Thank you everybody for listening. And with that, I will say good night. And on the count of 3, we can all say good night. So 1, 2, 3. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.